Thanks for visiting studiolighting.net. You're listening to Light Source. And welcome to episode 22 of Light Source, the official podcast of studiolighting.net, the website that introduces photographers to studio lighting and portrait equipment and techniques. I'm Bill Crawford, publisher.
And I'm Ed Hidden, the horse photographer. I'm Ed Hidden, exclusive photographer and image inspector with iStockPhoto.com. This week, I have a cold and I sound funny. But after that, we have John Schaefer with us with Schaefer Smith Photography, who specializes in still life and product and food photography. It's a very interesting interview, and it's kind of inspired us to get out our eggs and shoot our eggs.
Lots of eggs.
Yeah, more information on what that's all about later in this episode. But first, some news.
Yeah, there's a few things I thought were interesting in the news this week. Just in passing, I guess we should confirm that the Nikon D80 was a real camera and actually was released this week, along with what I thought were a couple of interesting lenses, which I wasn't expecting.
That 70-300 VR lens looks really nice.
Yeah, definitely. 70-300 VR and an 18-135 DX zoom, so pretty cool.
But that's an amazing range.
Yeah, I was thinking that would be handy, as long as it was it's not that fast, but it would do for like an all-around good lens to have.
Yeah, certainly.
But there's a whole bunch of lighting news as well. Something we kind of let slip by in July was that at the end of the month, PhotoFlex, manufacturer of traditionally continuous lighting equipment, we had Gene Kester, their founder, on the show a while back. They actually are in the monolight business now with introduction of their new Starflash line. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
It looks pretty slick. They have a 300-watt second, 650, and a 1,000-watt second model, so they have some pretty powerful systems there. They look really nice. I mean, look well-built.
Yeah, nice and sturdy. They are supposed to be shipping in late September. And, reasonably priced as well, I thought, for the wattage that you're looking at.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at the site right now. They do look like they're pretty decent. They look like they're a little bit more expensive than Alien Bees, but not as expensive as something like a Bowens or something like that.
Right. So another opportunity for beginners or folks that are already using PhotoFlex equipment and would like to stick with the name.
And then something else to add to those Starflash lights is the new Pocket Wizard Plus 2 system.
Ah, that sounds cool.
Yeah, everyone's a big fan of Pocket Wizards. You see it all over the place, but it looks like now the Pocket Wizard system is switching their unit over. Instead of having a transceiver and a receiver, they're going to have an auto-sensing transceiver that will work in whichever mode that you have it in, so you don't have to buy separate units. You can just buy as many of these plus two units as you would need.
Nice.
And they just work in whatever format that you would need them to work.
See, that's a great idea. So you can just have like a box of them and dig in.
Instead of showing up at a wedding and having four receivers and no transmitter.
Right, yeah. Well, I guess it would
be horrible.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a good thing. That would also be cool to have. I mean, if something breaks, that would be nice because you're not, you don't have to replace it with a specialized part. You can just grab another one.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you have multiple ones that do the exact same thing. So along with reducing the cost of it, you're building backup into it.
Did they change the price?
I don't believe so. It looks like the price is about $170 per unit on some of the online sites.
Great.
So, yeah, it makes it really, really attractive. You can put a system together pretty cheaply.
No doubt. I don't think you can really beat the Pocket Wizards they're just by far the most popular wireless flash triggering devices out there.
It's hard to go against something that's been labeled as such a standard.
Right. Anything kind of quirky in the news this month?
I really haven't found a whole lot of quirky other than some of the photos that I've been uploading lately.
I'm really?
kind of in my quirky mode. I'm trying to do a lot of a lot of absurd concepts and things like that. So
I've been digging the Flickr feed. You've been putting some cool stuff up there.
Well, I did a shoot this past weekend, and there's a couple, like couple, three photos that that were able to be taken pretty much out of the camera right onto Flickr. But the other ones that I have sitting here on the drive are going to take a bit of Photoshop work to them. They're probably going to be full illustrations, kind of Burt Monroy style once I'm done with them.
Nice. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, hopefully they come out as good as they do. They look at my head.
Right. That's always the challenge for me.
It's like, if only I can match it.
Well, I can bring up one quirky thing since you're out of them for this month. I found a cool little product from Sony. For anyone out there that's shooting with Sony digital cameras, they have a new device. It's called a GPS-CS1, which Sony's always good at coming up with strange names. But it's basically a GPS receiver that you take with you as you, whatever, go out and shoot photos. You can kind of clip it on your backpack. And when you get back, this device, when you plug it in, the Sony software looks at the GPS coordinates and matches them to the photos that you took by the timestamp. And it tags all of your images with GPS coordinates.
Oh, no, that's so cool.
You can put them on a map or whatever. Yeah, it's pretty neat.
So that way you don't have to pay for something very expensive to do that into your camera.
Right. It would be cool because, you know, I know it would be handy, at least for me, to refer to where exactly I was when I took such and so image, and just another step in helping me organize. I thought that was pretty neat.
I take it back. I do have another quirky thing that I found.
Oh, all right.
This one actually came through a newsletter that I'm subscribed to called Photo Jojo. And they did an article about something called a blender pen transfer.
I saw that article.
You
did?
That
was cool, yeah.
It was very cool. I got to get myself one of these things.
Tell us about it.
Well, it's a blender pen. And what you do is you take a photo and you use this blender pen over top of it. It has a solvent called xylene in it. It says it's highly toxic, so you probably want to use it in a very highly ventilated area, and you know, don't want your kids to get a hold of it and think that it's, you know, a popsicle. But basically, you just take it over like a print or something, and you use this blender pen, and then you transfer it after you get it kind of like moist, so you can. I'm thinking of it for like my little sketchbook thing.
Oh, yeah.
Take a couple of my prints and print them out and transfer them into my sketchbook. So that way, you know, if I'm thinking about one of the images that I've shot, instead of using the method that I use now, which is print something out and glue it into it, I can actually just transfer an image into the paper, and that way my book doesn't become 2 inches thick.
That's a great idea. Yeah, and they had some really creative uses for it on their website as well. We'll have to put a link in the show notes to that so people can check that out.
It reminds me a lot of like Polaroid transfer techniques that I used to play with.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Well, before we actually get into this week's interview, we got an email from a sharp listener named Pat who pointed out that we made a mistake or two in our last podcast.
Us? So,
yeah, it's hard to believe. But I double-checked his facts, and he's in fact right. We actually made a mistake.
No, wait a minute. That was a guest show. No, that was all us.
Yep, we can't even blame it on our guests. But I just wanted to correct ourselves officially on the air. One thing that I said was that raw image files are 16-bit images. Pat pointed out that most DSLRs store images that are about 12 bits worth of information. And that even though when you're working on them in Photoshop in the 16-bit color space, the files actually don't have that much data in them. So I apologize to the mathematicians out there.
What's a few bits?
The other observation that he made, which was actually kind of interesting, and I hadn't thought of this, but he went all the way back to episode 6, as we referred to with the different lengths of lenses for one of the reader's questions, and pointed out that each lens length had a different effect on the actual image and whether it was flat or deeper in dimension. And he pointed out that as when we said the crop factor played into it, we wrongly indicated that the crop factor needed to be accounted for when you're picking a focal length in order to affect the dimensions in the photograph. So we said that if you wanted to get the effect of a 100 millimeter lens and you had a crop factor of 1.5 or 1.6, you would have to actually use focal length in the 60 millimeter range. And he's pointing out that it actually, when you're talking about the perspective control, you put a 100 millimeter lens on a DSLR, even though there's a crop factor, the perspective is going to be just like it would have been on a full frame camera. Am I explaining myself well?
Yeah, that makes sense, because the perspective isn't really controlled by the lens. The perspective is controlled by your distance to the subject.
Right.
So you're still going to be at the same distance. It's just a matter of a different cropping.
Right. So if you want the effect of a 100 millimeter lens, you actually need to use a 100 millimeter lens, and your image is going to be somewhat smaller. So thank you, Pat.
Yeah, thanks, Pat. Great. We're going to have to get a fact checker now before we release any of these shows to make sure that... can we have Pat on standby that we can just send him over to him ahead of time?
We'll have to do that. We'll have phone a friend. Either that or we're going to have to put a disclaimer at the beginning of each episode.
The opinions expressed by this episode are by two reasonable idiots.
There you go. We'll use that for the official verbiage right there.
Our guest tonight on Light Source is Jeff Schaefer from Schaefer Smith Photography, and that's at schaefersmith.com. Link will be available on studiolighting.net if you want to go to that and look at some of the images from our guest this evening while we're talking to him. And welcome to Light Source, Jeff.
Oh, thank you.
Now, Schaefer Smith Photography, that is, you guys are a husband and wife team with Don Smith and yourself, Jeff Schaefer. So what came first, the marriage or the photography hobby between the two of you?
Well, we actually met in college. We both went to Rochester Institute of Technology and majored in photography there. And I was actually looking for people that were, you know, that I could get a ride back to the Philadelphia area at the time. And my wife actually grew up in that same area. In fact, I actually had dated her her friend for a while there before I met her. So, and her friend said, "Oh, you'll probably like Dawn." And well, that worked out well for us, but not too well for her. So, so we ended up together, and right through college, and then after college, we initially went to Boston, and because my mother was living in New Hampshire, I went to New Hampshire first and got a job at a photo lab in Boston, and we were there for a couple of years. But we really wanted to really be working in a, you know, more in the shooting end of things. So we decided to go to New York and see if we could get jobs as assistants in New York City. So we did that together. And first I got a full-time job, and then Dawn got a full-time job working for different people. I worked initially for a people photographer named Peter Papadopoulos, who was doing a lot of ad work at the time. But I really wanted to work for a still life photographer, so eventually I got a job with a guy named Chris Collins, who's still shooting in the city. Does a lot of high-end advertising as well. And Dawn got a job with a special effects photographer, Michelle Trefkoff. I don't know, you may have heard of him. But so that's how we kind of got started and got together.
So you both have had the interest in still life and pretty much focused on that?
Yeah, my wife Dawn has always been interested in the food photography, especially. Actually, back in college, she shot a few jobs for some clients. Then there's a chain called Perkins Pancake House that's up in the upstate New York area, and she did some work for them while she was still in school. Also did some work for the supermarket chain up there with Wegmans, and also did one other job with a friend who was doing something for a company that made soy-based products. We did some work with her years ago for that, so you never know where people will end up.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of ending up, how you went from assistants to, I guess, having your own studio, right?
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, after I worked for the still life photographer for about a year, I had, you know, by then made some acquaintances in the assistant network in New York City, and a fellow RIT grad that I sort of knew through my wife worked for a food photographer, and my wife Dawn had tried to get a job there, but he really didn't like working with women that too much, but I was able to get the job there. So I worked for him for I actually worked for him for 3 years, and we would shoot just about every day, and we shot a lot of ad work. And as a result of that contact, when I started freelance assisting, I had gotten a call from one of the art directors we had worked with, who worked on a supermarket account in Connecticut. And he called me one day and said, "Hey, you know, we do this other thing up there. It's just all these product photos. It's like 250 product photos every month. Would you be interested in, you know, trying out this job, shooting this job? It has to be shot up in Connecticut." And we said, "Sure, why not?" So we were going up to Connecticut and renting a studio for about, 8 to 14 days out of the month, shooting this job and then coming back down. And after we did that about 5 or 6 times, we said, they offered us a year contract to do this. And we just said, "Yeah, let's just do this." And we were, you know, we're going back and forth so much, we just said, "Why don't we just move up here, because we have to do it up here anyway." That's what we ended up doing the first 4 years in business. We shot that job every month for 4 years. And towards the end, we were doing some of the food shots that were originally done by the photographer in New York. So it turned out to be quite a good jumping off point.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And you are the first product photographer that we've had on the show. So we've got a whole bunch of questions for you about your work. There's a lot of folks that have emailed us and asked us some things that we were hoping we could bounce by you tonight. What are some of the challenges to working with still life?
Well, you run into quite a few things that might be quite difficult to light. I mean, basically everything kind of boils down to a square, a cylinder, or a pyramid, more or less, or a sphere. And within that, you have these things that are also highly reflective. So you really need to have a good control over the lighting in order to be able to let the object, you know, see what you want it to see, especially if it's highly reflective. Within those shapes, you've got things that are made of metal and glass, and just, you know, and learning how to treat those things differently. It's definitely a different kind of mood when you're shooting a product than it is with shooting people, because I also shoot some people as well. And it's... people with different temperament, really. I think the people that shoot still life primarily tend to be more of a control freak than, say, someone who shoots people, for the most part. That's not always true, but in general, it attracts someone who's really interested in extreme control over the image. For me, I kind of like being able to go back and forth once in a while, because it keeps you from getting a little in a rut to a certain extent. But, a lot of people that shoot people primarily have some trouble with shooting still life because they don't have the patience for it. It can take a very long time sometimes to light certain things, especially things like jewelry or something like that.
Is that because you need to watch every reflection and every change you make? Or?
Sure. Jewelry is especially difficult. I don't shoot too much of that, but I run into it every once in a while. And, to really make it really work, especially if it's not particularly high quality stuff, it can be very, very time consuming to try and get it to really look like something and look like something that somebody would want. So you could spend hours just moving little things around, tiny, you know, few millimeters, and then, you know, shooting another shot or whatever. So some people don't really have the patience to do something like that. They've had enough after about an hour or two of that. So, you know, it depends. you know, I enjoy working with things like that to a certain extent. Like some of the things that you shoot that maybe are a little more technical, or things involving liquids and, you know, splashes and things like that, where you might need to freeze the motion or capture it at the peak of the motion or something like that. So, you know, that combined with all those other issues can make for some real interesting technical problems to solve.
Well, speaking of splashes, how do you deal with a lot of those? Like, I've read in a lot of different forums people talking about using like modeled splashes and things like that to.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you do that, or do you go with just trying to get the timing right on everything?
Well, it really depends a lot on what, you know, what degree. Like if I get a layout from an art director, of course these days they don't draw them very much. Usually they'll just comp it in Photoshop or something like that. But if they want the liquid to behave in some way that I know for a fact it's not going to do.
Right.
Sometimes it's, you could have an acrylic model made, but these days also you could also shoot the splashes in pieces, and it can be put together in Photoshop. So you're actually making the splash out of several real splashes. Because sometimes the acrylic models can look a little fake.
Sure,
right.
Without question. I've seen some very good ones. And it really, like I said, it really kind of depends on the situation, whether you do that. So there's also some situations where maybe you would use the acrylic model for part of it, but then, you know, combine it with some real liquid splashing into it, or maybe composite it into it. An example might be, like, say you had a really elaborate drink that needed to have a lot of styling, like, I don't know, say a pina colada or something, where you've got all this stuff in it, you know, all this fruit and stuff in it, and it's everything's so carefully placed. If you're going to do a splash into that, you're not going to want to have to restyle it every shot.
Right.
So maybe you're going to use a partially acrylic thing, acrylic model into that, or maybe you would, you know, shoot the pina colada as is and then take out the stuff and do some where you actually splash some into the thing and then take that element and put that together in Photoshop, that kind of a thing.
Okay, so sounds like post-processing is equally as important as the actual shot for you?
In this case, yeah, especially now that we shoot almost everything digital now, so
okay.
Which has really helped with things like splashes, because you know immediately whether you've got something you can work with. And then, you know, either doing the retouching, or I did a thing recently where I was working with some retouchers, and I kind of gave them a rough composite of what I wanted, and then they just took it a little bit further.
Okay.
So it really depends on the situation. It depends on what kind of a look they want, you know, what kind of budget they have.
Right.
You know, sometimes the acrylic models are more expensive than doing the retouching. So,
wow.
Because they're basically all carved out of acrylic, so that can be very quite expensive to do.
Huh.
You have to kind of look at each situation, you know, each layout individually that way.
Now, in terms of the when you're working with doing these splashes and you're capturing these fractions of a second where the liquid is still in a gel shape, what sort of shutter
right.
speed are we looking at when you're doing something like
well,
that?
Well, in that case, shutter speed is really less of a factor than the flash duration, because at that point, some of the things that you're shooting is you need a flash duration of anywhere from a thousandth of a second or shorter. If you're using a camera with a leaf shutter, you could be on a 500th, you could be on a 250th. It doesn't really matter, because the flash duration is what's going to actually determine how frozen liquid is to a certain extent. You might pick up a tiny bit of ambient light at that point, but the modeling lights are really pretty weak compared to the actual flash output, so it's really the flash duration that's determining, you know, what degree of frozen motion you have.
Now, how do you, is there a way to adjust them on the Alien Bees?
Well, there's a couple of specialized units that can do it now. I still have this, and I use it occasionally, but there's more sophisticated ways to do it now. But I used to use a Speedotron quad head, and depending on how much, it has four flash tubes in it, and I would take each flash tube and put it into the lowest power setting that I could. So on a Speedotron power pack, that's like 400 watt-seconds into each tube. And because one of the issues is that you get a shorter flash duration with lower flash output.
Right.
And that used to be a huge problem with film, because I used to shoot like 8x10 film. And you have the opposite problem. You need more light
need
for
more,
8x10
yeah.
film. But you also need a really short flash duration. So when that was the case, in those days, I used to use specialized equipment. There was Broncolor makes a special unit where you can actually dial in the flash duration and light output that you want. The Pulso units do that. I think it's the Pulso A4 or whatever. Those I would usually rent for that particular situation, because a day-to-day you don't necessarily need a $9,000 flash to do the job. But there was also, before all that, there used to be a unit that people used. It was called the Ascor Sun Gun. It was like from the 1950s. There were all these sort of like pigtail connectors between all these individual capacitors. And so you could actually run up to 10,000 watt seconds through one flash tube and get a flash duration of a 10,000th of a second.
Wow. It sounds dangerous.
It scared the hell out of everybody when the thing went off.
It sounded
like
dangerous.
A rifle going off. But it would do the job.
Wow.
So that's the way it used to be done. Now, fortunately, with digital, you need far less light output, and you can use some of these specialized units like the Broncolor Pulso can do it, or the Profoto 7A, and you can dial down the flash duration based on the power setting. Once again,
wow.
It'll go down pretty short. I think it'll go down to like a 6,000th of a second, but you're not going to have much light coming out at that point. So
right.
You might have to combine several packs or whatever to get enough light on the subject.
Now, in terms of cameras, you mentioned a leaf shutter, but is that all you shoot at your studio, or do you introduce some DSLRs and things like that as well?
Oh yeah. We kind of look at these days with digital, we kind of look at the needs of the client. You know, what is the largest size image that you project you would ever need for the image?
Okay.
And in many cases, we can shoot with a Canon 1DS or even a Canon 5D, and it's more than enough resolution, because most things we shoot get printed, 8.5 by 11, 9 by 12,
right.
Something like that. You don't need huge amounts of resolution. In some, in some ways, it's overkill. But if we shoot for something like sales promotion, like some of the beverage stuff that we shoot is for sales promotion agencies, and they can be quite large because they're like in-store displays.
Right.
And that I've had images where I shot someone full figure, and they were reproduced nearly life-size.
Oh wow, that's neat.
On a cardboard display in the store that you could stand right next to. So you need lots of resolution for that.
Sure.
So in that case, I would usually these days what I do is I rent the digital back and camera, just because it's very expensive to buy and the technology is constantly changing. So to me, it's not really cost effective to buy the unit. I just rent it as I need it.
That makes sense. No, along the lines of cameras, we got a question a couple of weeks back from someone who was looking to do small product photography, mainly tabletop stuff. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about your lighting and things like that in a minute. But how does lens selection play into things for you? Do you use that as a creative element? And how does
Sure.
Could you talk about the differences of the different focal lengths and stuff, and why you might choose one over the other?
Well, if I'm shooting, I used to shoot, we used to shoot everything with a 4x5 or 8x10 view camera. So there we had movements that we could, you know, adjust perspective and we could tilt the lens board if need be. But many jobs, it's not really necessary. But if I'm shooting, say, a bottle shot or something like that, I might go with a little bit longer lens just so that we have nice, clean, you know, the bottle, the sides of the bottle are parallel and things like that without having to necessarily go to a view camera setup. So, it, you know, especially in things that are reproduced smaller, it's just easier to shoot with a digital SLR than it is to shoot with with a view camera in that situation.
Right.
You know, the view camera combined with a digital back is kind of an awkward setup, and it's, you know, it'll get what you want, but, you know, if, a lot of times now you could shoot with a longer lens, and then if you had to do some slight perspective correction in Photoshop, you could do it then. So there would be a reason to use the longer lenses.
Now, you mentioned using the longs when you were trying to get the perspective to be as, you know, correct as possible, but do you also use some shorter lenses sometimes?
Oh, yeah, definitely. If we're trying to exaggerate perspective, you know, we'll go to a much wider lens. It really depends on the, you know, what the shot calls for. But I'd say most of the time with product, we're usually in the slight telephoto range for most things.
When you say slight telephoto, what sort of number are we talking about?
Well, you would be on, you know, in a digital SLR, you might be anywhere from, you know, 100 to 180, something like that range.
Okay. If someone was interested in getting started in product photography, it seems like something they could start in their home. And if so, what would be like the minimum basic requirements in terms of just lighting equipment in general?
Well, you can do a lot with a little in tabletop situation. I do, you know, one of the things I run into when I teach a lighting class, and one of the things I run into with some of the students is that many of them could use a macro capability on their camera lenses for some of these things, if you're especially small product. So that's one thing. It would be nice to have a macro lens. Tripod's essential. But as far as lighting goes, you can get by with quite a simple setup. You could go with a very simple tungsten lighting. I've even been able to show students what they can do with just a photo flood, you know, bouncing it or diffusing it in various ways. So you really don't need a ton of equipment to get started.
Okay.
In fact, I recommend people start with a tungsten light because it's much easier to judge what's happening with the with the image. You basically can see the lighting.
Right.
Whereas with flash, sometimes it can be a little misleading. The modeling light may look one way, but when the flash tube goes off, it could be quite a bit softer. So,
sure.
That can confuse a lot of people at first.
When you talk about diffusing your light, do you prefer to use panels or do you recommend softboxes? What do you usually tell your students to, if they were going to invest in a modifier?
Well, softboxes are very convenient, without question. You know, if you can get one that'll fit. They have them for tungsten lights. They have them for strobe. Very easy to put the thing on, and usually pretty quick to set up. I find sometimes that depending on what you're shooting, like if you're shooting something highly reflective, like glass or metal, a lot of times you're actually better having a regular head or light with a reflector and putting it through some sort of diffusion material, like it could be through plexiglass or some of the Roscoe material that they make that's for diffusion. I use Roscoe Tough Lux as one material that I use. But you can use tracing paper too. Tracing paper has a nice quality of diffusing the light as well. So I find that if I use that behind a panel like that, I can feather the light one direction or another and control the tonality. You know, you get more of a tonal highlight. It's not just a flat white highlight.
Right.
So I think that gives you a little more control shooting through something like that.
So when we're talking about control, And you're talking about like dealing with some of these objects, and a lot of these are pretty small. You know, maybe they're strawberries or olives or some mm-hmm. other little thing like that. How do you work with keeping them in place? Because it's not like it's a person that you can say, stand there, don't move.
Well, for the most part, a lot of still life things are more cooperative than people in that respect. But
come on, work with me.
They don't care if they're sitting under there under hot lights all day long.
That's true.
But we use materials to rig things. We use one material we use a lot is called Funtac. You can get it in just your typical discount stores. It's supposed to be meant for hanging up posters on walls without, you know, when you take it down, it doesn't peel off the
yeah,
paint
yeah,
or anything.
That
like
stuff
that.
Never works. It always peels the paint off.
It never worked for that. But it works great in the studio. I never used it to hang up a poster. I just thought that never seemed to work very well.
Yeah, it doesn't
but,
work for that.
But it works great in the studio if we want to set something and I can angle a card on. I could put a card on it and angle that a bunch of different directions, or I can prop something up with it. So we use things like that. We use armature wire, which, you know, that's used for sculpture. Comes in different widths and thicknesses that you can, you know, so some are stiffer than others. It depends on how heavy the object is you're trying to rig up. Little acrylic blocks, sometimes we use like little tiny weight, like fishing weights or lead weights, you know, to just kind of hold something down or rig it in position. So, you know, whatever works really, but those are the most common things that we're using. Sometimes we also use a mortician's wax that you can buy places like the Set Shop in New York. That you can buy it online from them if you can't find it other places.
I was hoping you were.
You just peel it off.
I was hoping you weren't going to send us to a mortuary to get photo supplies.
Well, yeah, I don't even know if I don't even know if morticians actually use it, but that's what they call it.
That's funny.
Yeah, or you know, like you go to Madame Tussauds and break one of the fingers off or something.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I needed that, you know. So, but you know, it just little things like that. Sometimes it takes a little ingenuity. We also, like, if you have fairly light objects and you need to suspend them, you can use tungsten wire. Huh. It's very strong, but it's so thin that you really just about can't even see it sometimes. So, those are some other things we use.
So you're practically a part, like, set designer, model maker, as well as the photographer.
Well, sometimes. It depends. So you have to figure out how to rig it up sometimes.
It sounds like there's a lot of opportunities for creativity, that's for sure.
I tell you, I'm finding a whole new respect for still life photographers, because I've been trying so hard lately to work more with models and things like that. I'm thinking that I need to invest some more time doing some still life work.
Well, it's a different discipline, and I think probably the biggest benefit from doing still life is that even if you shoot almost all exclusively people, one of the things you'll get is you'll probably find out a few new things about lighting, that just little subtle things that maybe you can use when you photograph a person, maybe like in creating a particular mood or something like that. Because, you know, we're trying to create a mood a lot of times with the product too.
Sure.
You know, it's like, should this be a high key shot? Should this be like a low key shot? What are we trying to say about this product, or what are we trying to enhance, or what are we trying to hide? You know, because we also have to hide things about some of these products. Some of them are not the most attractive things in the world, and yet we have to make them look like they are. So I think I spend a lot of time just observing lighting on objects, you know, day to day. You find yourself noticing that more.
Right.
When you start doing that.
Now, let's talk about reflections for just a few minutes. That's probably one of the big challenges for somebody getting into product photography. Mm-hmm. How do you decide, you know, if you want a soft reflection or a hard reflection, and does it determine by the surface of the object, and, you know, how do you make those sort of decisions?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, that's what you're looking for. I mean, more or less, the general rule of thumb is if you have a really highly reflective object, you're going to probably want to start with maybe a larger source, a more diffused source initially. It's not always the case. I've seen some things recently where some of the car photographers are lighting cars with Kinoflow light sources, which is basically a fluorescent tube. And you can get them in like an array of, you know, maybe there might be four or eight in an array, but they're also, you also can mount them end to end. And some of the highlights they've been putting on cars, they're just taking like a, you know, two Kinoflows and making this really long, thin highlight on it. So in that sense, they're using a kind of a fairly specular source to light something that normally is lit with usually a huge light source. And getting this, you know, it kind of follows the contour of the car hood, which is one of the big things that they're trying to play up a lot of times. Sometimes you can break the rules like that, the general rule. You know, normally you would light a car with, you know, a 20-foot wide, you know, 20-foot long softbox. But here they're taking something like that and maybe even breaking up the lighting and shooting it digitally. They might shoot one exposure where they're lighting it with this long tube, and then there's another exposure where they're taking the tube, you know, a small bank of tubes, and they're lighting, say, just the wheel, and getting a diffused highlight on that. And so it's all combined into one. So you can even, with digital, you can kind of even create impossible lighting situations.
That's a good way to minimize your equipment.
They ask you to do things that are impossible, so
sure.
That's the way to solve that problem.
You want the front and the back lit.
Yeah, things like that come. Believe me, things like that come up all the time. So, that's a beauty of digital. You know, you can shoot if you got the camera really held down. If you know, put some extra sandbags on the tripod or whatever. Digital registers perfectly, one exposure right onto the other. Right. As long as the camera doesn't move in between, you can shoot one and the other, and those images will line right up. So you can many times shoot one, you know, an exposure for the highlights, exposure for the shadows, and put them together. Sometimes that's the way you have to do it.
Now,
so I prefer to do it with lighting if I can, but there's sometimes you just can't.
Sure.
Now, when you're talking about combining them, do you do them with layers and mask them, or do you use the, I guess Photoshop CS2 has the HDR feature in it?
Yeah, I mean you can do that. The way I learned to do it initially was before they had HDR, so I tended to use layer masks, and it allows you to, you know, allow it to come through in places and where you want in others. Whereas when you merge to HDR, you're taking a bunch of exposures, and it's you're kind of letting Photoshop decide that for you to a certain extent. Now, I have a friend who's an architectural photographer, and this is a real boon for him because he's often in a situation where, you know, you've got bright light sources right in the shot, and then, you know, he's doing a nighttime shot, and he wants to get the sky and, you know, and all these elements that are, you know, 25 stops apart, you know. So... It's perfect for him, you know, to be able to do that. And there are some shots where it's definitely going to lend itself to that. And it's just kind of, like I said, I haven't used it that much, but I think that if, if the shot fits within the range, and I guess it's just something you have to learn from experience, you know, whether it's going to fit within that range that would work well in HDR. But, you know, you can always go the route of making a layer and using a layer mask, and that gives you total control over where it's going to show and where it isn't.
Before we get too far off of that basic setup I asked you about, how do you feel about these light tents that are on the market today? Is that something you'd recommend, or do you think it sort of takes some of the intelligence out of the situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're really kind of meant for, say, shooting something that's going to go on the web, you know, quickly. If you're going to just want to get a record shot of the object and get it up there, it's certainly an expedient way. And then some of them do have controls, like you can turn off certain lights and leave others on, so you can actually get some kind of directionality to the light. because normally the way I've seen those things used is they're basically just throwing light everywhere, which is, it's pretty dull light, to be honest.
Just flat.
It's just blah. There's no shadows. There's no direction. You know, we're used to, I've always kind of worked off the theories like, okay, natural light is one single light source. And we're used to seeing that kind of thing. I mean, we're kind of conditioned to see that. I mean, granted, we live a lot in artificial light where there may be several shadows and things like that. But I think most people instinctively are drawn to something that seems to have one single light source and coming from one particular direction as the primary source of light.
Right.
And so I kind of use that as a model. And daylight is wonderful quality. I mean, one of the things that's kind of difficult to capture sometimes about daylight is that it can be both diffuse and specular at the same time. You can have a hard edge to it, but yet it's such a, you know, when the sky fills up with light, that becomes this kind of large light source, and then you have this, because the sun's so far away, it becomes like such a sharp light source as well. It's kind of hard to replicate that sometimes in the studio. Sometimes you actually have to combine a diffuse source with a directional source to get that quality.
How would if somebody wasn't going to use a tent, how do you avoid reflections of your equipment and of yourself in a shiny surface like stainless steel or something like that?
Question of the
hour. Well, some of it is choosing a good camera angle. I've had to shoot recently, been doing some stuff for Macy's online, and they have a lot of flatware, and you might have to shoot like 25 pieces of flatware in the shot, and forks and spoons, especially spoons, it'll show everything. So they tend to want to make it look like you're shooting directly overhead, but that's really a totally impractical angle to shoot flatware from, because if you shoot directly overhead, it's going to see the camera, it's going to see anything that's around the camera, including you if you happen to be standing there. So we kind of cheat the angle a little bit, and we would go a little bit off directly down. You might be, leaning a little bit more towards almost a 45, not quite that much, but cheat in that direction a little bit. There might be a good use right there for the tilt shift lens, where you could, correct the perspective a little bit. Or if you shift the lens up, then you can also be a little bit further back and further away from where that spoon is going to reflect you, that kind of a thing. So that'd be a good use for that. And then you just got to be careful about where you place the light. Most of the time, in the flatware, you can usually light it with one light source. I usually use like some sort of diffusion material. It could be like a piece of plexiglass or a piece of tracing paper or this Roscoe stuff I was telling about. And I kind of angle it at like a 45-degree angle over the set. So the back end is at the very end of the set, and the top end is coming up. And then I might put black or white cards on the side, and that will take care of the reflections of the spoon, because the spoon's going to see out to the sides and also to the front.
Okay.
So you might have cards all around the set, but then you're shooting through an opening between those cards, so you might be up at the top of that 45-degree angle, the camera's in there, but anything around the camera at that point is going to be so far away that it's essentially going to be seen as black. So it'll be one black section at the top, and the rest will be white or black, depending on where you put the cards.
Okay.
Around it. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know if I'm describing that well. But.
We'll have a bunch of people trying to photograph spoons when they get...
Yeah, spoons can be tough.
It sounds like it.
Although, generally, I feel like one of the things the light tent does that's undesirable, too, is that I think flatware, if it's anything other than pewter or something like that, it really should have some darks in it in order to get a sense of it, of how shiny it is. Because otherwise it just looks like pure white. you need to get either a little bit of tone in it, and you need to have some black in there somewhere. And usually that occurs in the spoons primarily, but it could occur at the edges of things too. And that gives it a little bit of sense of this is metal. This is, you know, this has some dimension instead of being just a flat, you know, white cutout or something like that.
So,
which is what you're going to get with a tent situation.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like from some things you've said that you pay attention to shadows and subtractive lighting as much as you do from the actual primary light source.
Oh, definitely.
So that's important.
Definitely. In fact, I just did, when I was doing this thing for Macy's, one of the things I was also shooting was bedding. And we had this, like, room set with a bed in there, and I'm using daylight, but then we're supplementing it with strobe for mostly fill. And I'll tell you, primarily, the daylight was coming through the back window, and I had some shots where we were facing west and some shots where on a later date when we were facing north. You know, north light's pretty consistent. But when I was shooting west, basically what I had to do with the daylight is it was mostly a subtractive lighting. It was mostly setting up flags or cards to try and keep light off certain parts of the bedding so it wouldn't burn out or so that it would have some detail. So there it was like totally subtractive lighting.
Wow. That's cool.
Now, how do you approach a lot of your backgrounds that you come up with? I mean, where do you get the ideas? And I mean, so many of these have like these beautiful fades of color or the like highlights, like they're just kind of like suspended in their own little universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, like there, a lot of that is created with light too. I mean, you might have a simple background, but a lot of this stuff. Especially like small products, a lot of times that's just shot on acrylic or something like that. I have a piece of 4x8 plexiglass that's sandblasted on one side, so one side of it's matte and the other side's glossy. And so I can kind of use that as the surface, and then that allows me to put lights behind it or underneath it so that I can get different tone and shade, and that I could put gel on that and get some color out of it. So you could basically do a lot with what is essentially a white surface. In fact, you could do in many of these things even with seamless. And sometimes I use like shiny silver boards, or there's some matte silver boards. There's a board called Florentine board which has like sort of a linear pattern in it, brushed aluminum. Things like that. It's pretty simple, really. A lot of it's just done through how you light it. You know, using the reflections. Like you can basically kind of you could make something appear to you could get a pick up a reflection on the surface, but have the rest be like a void, just by putting a piece of clear acrylic or a piece of white acrylic on white seamless, and if you pump enough light into the background, you won't see the line where that piece ends. It'll just disappear.
Oh, okay.
Because it'll be all reflection. It's seeing all that reflection from the white, so that background edge is just gone.
That is cool.
Yeah, it's a pretty standard. Actually, that was Irving Penn did a lot of stuff with that.
Okay.
And it's kind of a fashion technique also. You'll see them shoot people with that too. They'll just get a big piece of plexiglass. They'll be standing on that and just blow out the background, and that back edge just disappears.
That's neat.
So you get this nice hard reflection, and then that. It would work with a matte surface too, but not as strongly, obviously.
Well, I predict that in our Flickr pool, we'll be seeing a lot of everyone trying out their still life shots and uploading them now.
Absolutely.
Well, that'll be good.
Yeah, we encourage that. You mentioned that you teach a lighting course. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? And is this something that is open to the public? Can people get involved?
Oh yeah, definitely. Well, basically I kind of got involved in it with a local community college. I've been doing it off and on for like the last 10 years, and it kind of constantly evolves because I do. It's like a basic course initially, and then I had a, have a more advanced one that I teach for people that want to go further. But the school has a facility that they have a small studio, and I can have people work in the studio, and I can kind of oversee what they're doing. And then I also give them assignments that they can do on their own at home with simple lighting setups or even daylight. It's been fairly popular with the, you know, kind of advanced amateurs.
That's great.
Who want to learn a little bit more about doing these sorts of things. We usually cover, the first assignment is actually a basic still life assignment, just to get a sense of the qualities of light. I have everybody shoot an egg on a white piece of paper.
That's great.
And what you have to do is, by using either a hard directional light initially, you do some shots with, you know, giving it a different character from, you know, lighting it from different angles, all with one light source. Use a hard source first, and then we do some with a soft source, and try and make it look as different as possible with all those within those limitations.
Hmm.
So I kind of do a demo first in class, and then they kind of work with it, and we've had to work in groups of like two or three, but that actually works out great because one person can kind of be the other person's assistant.
Sure.
And move lights around for them. So that's been working out pretty well, and that, you know, at first people were like, why are we doing this, you know? Why are we taking a picture of these eggs? You know, but then once they get into it, they begin to see that how much you can do with one single light, you know.
Sure.
And where you place it is really everything. And by working at least initially with tungsten lights, they begin to see that. And then we start working with electronic flash because they have a bunch of electronic flash units in the studio.
That sounds like a great way for people to get the feel for that. And plus, everybody needs a good picture of an egg for their wall or their den or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Well, I stole this assignment from my professor at school.
That's great. Yeah.
we had this back at school, and I thought it was a really good assignment.
Absolutely.
He gave it to us, and he made us. He said, "I want you to have 36 different shots."
Oh.
You know, and, you know, you can't just shoot one roll of film and get that.
Wow.
So it was a tough assignment, but I think everybody learned a lot from doing that. And what I do for the students who don't have a macro lens is I actually have an ostrich egg, and I bring that in.
That's so great. So if somebody wanted to find out more about your class, what should they do? I mean, you can put
I'll be putting a link on the website that will they can go and they can download a course outline and the some an excerpt from some of the handouts.
Great.
Because I usually give out handouts of every class, and some of those have like some of the demonstrations that I do. I have this little statue there's like a carved wooden angel statue that I use as the model sometimes, and we show how to light that a bunch of different ways before we do our portrait exercise. Because he's a lot more cooperative than some of the other people in class.
That's great.
So, but you know, that's the kind of thing I'll probably post on on the site. So I'll just make a link for that.
And we'll certainly provide links to your site and to anything else that you'd like us to link to on the show notes for this episode. And Jeff,
oh, great.
Wanted to thank you very much for your time. I've had a great time talking with you and learning about all the ins and outs of product photography. So I appreciate it.
Oh, same here.
Before we go, we have a tradition on the show where we like to ask a handful of rapid fire questions just for something fun to do. Are you up for it?
Sure.
Okay. How about we start with a simple one, like digital or film?
Well, these days I'm preferring digital just because of workflow and some of the things that are more convenient. I mean, it's really reached a point where the quality is surpassed film in some respects. So certainly a lot more flexible way to go right now.
Favorite magazine.
Favorite magazine? Oh, that's a tough one.
I'm going to guess it's not going to be a photography one.
Well, actually, my most recent favorite magazine was, it's kind of an obscure one. It's called Topic, where they divide the entire magazine is devoted to a single topic.
Oh, that's cool.
They have they just most recent one was on music, and what they do is that people are they have kind of open contributions, and then they have very tight editing at that point. People contribute different stories, and then they'll devote the entire issue to it. And there's very few advertisements in it. It's I don't know where they're. It's only a quarterly publication, but it's really well done and very interesting. They have good use of photography also.
I was gonna say I think I saw it featured in a photography magazine.
It could be. I found out about it from an email from the Art Directors Club. So. And I actually had trouble finding it even in New York City. So.
Oh, wow. It might be a hard one to track down.
Well, you can go to topicmag.org, and they actually have some excerpts on there from there. They even did one issue on sin, and the articles were one article was about a guy who sold used cars, and he explained all the techniques and,
oh, wow.
and ways that they can extract money from you.
That's
pretty interesting. Shut up. Well, I have a good segue from this one. Favorite topic to shoot?
Well, lately I've actually been liking to do like pinhole and Holga photographs for myself.
Hmm.
It's kind of the exact opposite of doing.
Yeah, I was going to say. That's...
I mean, I don't even know what I'm going to get a lot of times. So,
that's great.
Okay,
how about? If you were stuck in your studio with one light modifier and one strobe, what would you pick for the modifier?
Oh, okay. Well, just one. Hmm.
This is kind of a variation on the trapped on a desert island question.
Yeah. I was going to say desert island, but
your life isn't at stake.
You have this tube of lipstick to shoot.
And you can only pick one friend.
Well, let's see. Well, I guess you could. I guess it could just be. I mean, a roll of tracing paper would be fine. You know?
Great, that's a great
all
answer.
I had.
What is the smallest object you've ever shot?
Oh boy, I'd see. I'd have to say, I had to shoot a section of a computer chip once. it was actually a circuit board. And we shot it on 4x5, and basically what I did is, to get enough bellows extension, I had two 8x10 cameras back-to-back, and I had about 8 feet of bellows.
Wow.
and then an enlarging lens on the other end, and I'm like half an inch away from the thing. So
amazing.
That's about as small as I've had to shoot.
That counts.
You win.
Well, Jeff, again, I want to thank you for sharing with us and for taking time to talk with us. We've had you on here for over an hour, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, well, thanks for calling me.
Absolutely. Well, that's all we have for this episode of Light Source,
the brightest podcast on the internet.
Be sure to check out the show notes at studiolighting.net for the things that we talked about on today's show.
And there you can also find links about our photography and keep up with the stuff that we've been shooting.
And don't forget, you can send us feedback or questions about the show to studiolighting@gmail.com.
And we'll try to answer those questions on the show or in the lighting questions section on studiolighting.net.
You can also get feedback on your photography in our Flickr group, which is at www.flickr.com/groups/lightsource. Till next time.
Take care.